Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's been 6 days since Russia began the invasion of Ukraine, and while the death toll is still not accurate, more than 500,000 people have fled Ukraine. Amid the flood of updates, are people sharing their own take on what's going on there? And with anything that goes on in the world, misinformation and disinformation surrounding the Russian invasion of Ukraine is being shared across social media. And while misinformation is false or misleading information, it can be unintentional, and the person sharing it can be unaware that it isn't misinformation, but disinformation is deliberately created and shared to cause harm. We're going to take some time today with PolitiFact senior correspondent John Greenberg to fact-check statements made by Russian President Vladimir Putin, as well as posts being shared around the world. John, welcome to Insight.
Glad to be here.
I imagine you've been busy. Before we dive in, I really just want to gauge the level of misinformation and disinformation that you're scouring through. The war of this kind really hasn't been seen since World War II, but with that comes with the reality that it is heavily documented and shared in ways that really hasn't been seen before.
You know, the people who track the volume of misinformation saw a huge spike. I mean, there was one outfit that said in the days before the invasion, accounts that are associated with the Russian government, there was an increase on something like they said like 11,000%.
Wow.
And these were, statements that were basically all touting anti-Ukraine, pro-Russian talking points, casting Ukraine as the aggressor and, as Russia as the savior of people in Ukraine. So an enormous volume.
Given that PolitiFact has a partnership with Facebook, you're scouring through these posts. What are some of the more common examples of misinformation and disinformation that you're encountering?
When people share inaccurate information, and I think you basically alluded to this, they're drawn to what they see because it has an emotional kick. And so what we've been spotting a lot of is old images, old video that's dramatic, and people share it. So like 30 years ago, two Russian jets collided in an air show over England. And there's great pictures of it. People share the pictures saying, oh, this is, the Ukrainian forces shooting down Russian jets. And obviously the picture has nothing to do with the current fighting in Ukraine. There was one interesting real video of Russian paratroopers descending, landing. And it's real, but it showed up in 2015. So it was presumably part of an exercise. We don't know where, but it certainly has nothing to do with the fighting. And that's the most common sort of sharing that we see. By the way, I should also mention that some people are sharing video from video games, little video wow. snippets. So that's semi-amusing, but not necessarily a great compliment to people's ability to discern truth from fiction.
Right, and the dangers of that. Another falsehood that went viral was that Russia was going into Ukraine because the United States had bioweapons and military labs in Ukraine. There are even screenshots of maps where the supposed bioweapons labs are located, but the United States doesn't run any labs in Ukraine. So how was this possible?
Well, there are research labs in Ukraine, and some of them do indirectly get funding from the U.S. But the big fallacy, and you alluded to this, they're not run by the United States. These are labs that are designed to help, control any use of biological warfare. And they're not bioweapon labs. That's a completely wrong characterization of what they are. So this is an interesting case because you can find some threads of accuracy in where this comes from, But the substance of it is just way off the mark.
Yeah, a kernel of truth surrounded by completely false context. Would you say overall, when you're encountering these posts on social media, that they're mostly people unaware that it's false, or they're unaware that it's misleading, you know, maybe not knowing the context surrounding that photo or that post? Or is there more of an intent to distribute false information, you know, like straight up hoaxes?
Yeah, so this is really difficult to tease out. Certainly, you know, for your average person who shares misinformation, they believe it when they see it. They think it may be interesting. Maybe they don't buy it completely, but they are, you know, sharing it with their friends to say, well, this is worth putting on your radar screen. But at the same time, we know that people and institutions associated with the Russian government are flooding the zone. So they're putting a lot of fodder out there. Some of it gets picked up by, you know, very innocent folks. Best way to talk about it in the absence of really crystal clear data is to say there's the possibility of a mix at any moment.
And I think what you're hinting at really is that there's misinformation and disinformation, and then you have propaganda. And in Russia, that is also rampant. And you have tech companies like Facebook, Google, Twitter, even TikTok. They're grappling with shutting down the misinformation that's being spewed. And you've actually fact-checked claims by Russian President Vladimir Putin. What are some of the more egregious falsehoods that you've come across?
Well, I think that a very clear talking point from Putin is that Ukraine was engaged in a genocide against ethnic Russians. And if you listen to his announcement of the attack, he talks about this genocide, and he also talks about the need to denazify Ukraine. Now, this is all, first of all, let's be really clear. There was no genocide underway. I mean, the area of eastern Ukraine is hardly any place where you can keep a secret. There are reporters, there are individuals with their social media accounts, and there are multinational bodies in there tracking what's going on. In fact, Russia belongs to one of those international bodies. And if you just take a look, I hate to put it so crudely, but at the body count. In 2014, over 2,000 civilians died in eastern Ukraine. In 2021, the number was less than 20. So there is no way that you can have a genocide when you see numbers dropping like that to less than 1% of where they were at the start of the conflict. So just in terms of numbers, which is where we like to be, we like the numbers to do the talking. No, it is not going on. But when you take a look at the rhetorical use of talking about genocide and essentially saying the Ukrainians are Nazis, then what Putin is doing is he is firing up the Russian base with this kind of language, because they did fight the fascists, the Nazis, in the great, what they call the Great Patriotic War, we call World War II. And it is a point of great pride and national pride. So he plays to that and essentially says, we are the good guys fighting evil incarnate, because these people, these Ukrainians, are Nazis. That's effectively what he's doing. And it is a very, not only is it wrong, but it's very dangerous type of rhetoric.
What you're talking about takes a great deal of context to unpack and investigate on your part. How long does it take your PolitiFact team to fact check a post?
Well, it all depends on the post itself. I mean, when you're dealing with a false image, there are pretty good tools out there to track the history of an image or of a video. So you can see if it showed up before. And once you land on the evidence of this image having shown up years earlier, then, you know, it's basically case closed. Certainly genocide, in a sense, wasn't difficult to research because there's no evidence. I mean, you are faced with the issue of, well, there is no evidence, so what do you say? But in fact, you do have numbers showing that it could not be taking place. What does it take? It takes maybe about a day for that. Other things are a little more involved. You take more time, as much time as needed.
Yeah, given that people aren't necessarily going to devote a day to fact check it. And we started this conversation with you saying there was something of a number of 1,100% increase in misinformation and disinformation. Realistically, is it possible to actually stop or curb this? It kind of feels like whack-a-mole.
Oh, it certainly is. But one good thing is that, you know, say what you will about Facebook and so forth, they do have a good system in place. For once a post and an image certainly is identified as false, then their algorithms go to work and they restrict the spread of the false information, generally by putting kind of a mask over it and saying, look, independent fact checkers have found this to be wrong. You can see it if you want, but you can also read the truth. So those are, you know, some of the tools. TikTok does some of the same things. So yeah, I agree. We're always playing catch up, but we can make some headway against this. We're not totally defenseless.
John, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
John Greenberg is a senior correspondent for PolitiFact. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about misinformation surrounding the Russian invasion of Ukraine. We turn now to John Silva, who is the senior director of professional learning for the News Literacy Project. The nonprofit works with journalists and schools to help people understand how to discern fact from fiction when it comes to information that's being shared. John, welcome back to Insight.
Good morning, Vicky. I'm happy to be back.
All right, John. So cognitively, we know that misinformation and propaganda is dangerous, but it's crises like the one that's unfolding in Ukraine, where we see the scale of human cost to these posts and what they can provoke. Many of us feel helpless. We want to stay connected. We want to stay informed. How are you guiding people to do so responsibly?
You know, one of the most important things that we are trying to stress, you know, particularly when we're talking to educators who are wanting to talk about this with their students and whose students want to know more, is that there are a lot of different people and sources who are trying to manipulate us into believing things that are not true about the crisis in Ukraine. And in a way, we have the actual conflict on the ground in Ukraine, which has that very real human cost. But in a sense, there's also a war, you know, to coin a phrase, there's a war for the hearts and minds of social media. And so when we talk about that emotional appeal and the propaganda, it's not just coming from Russia, right? It's coming out of the Ukraine. And it's also coming from here in the United States, where people are trying to turn it towards their own political views. So the first step is we have to just take a step back and just kind of pause how we're scrolling through information. And then we have to decide what is it that we really want to know and focus on. And so when we talk about news literacy, when we talk about evaluating this, it's about, can I determine if this information is accurate and factual? And can I determine if this source is credible? And that's really where the skills that we want to especially teach young people, but also we would like some adults to start practicing those skills. You know, it's not just professional fact checkers that do these. It's also ordinary people. We can all use some of those same tools.
Yeah. And when you're scrolling, I mean, you're tapping into your emotions and your feelings, and that can make a post effective. But looking at other common themes, overall, what makes misinformation and disinformation effective?
The most powerful tool that is used besides the emotional manipulation is confirmation bias. We all have. It's a very natural thing that when we hear or see something that agrees with something we believe in, we just tend to accept it without really questioning it. And confirmation bias can be very easily exploited. And I think recognizing that and understanding sort of how your brain can be short-circuited by something kind of helps us put the brakes on it. And hopefully in that pause, right, we kind of calm down our emotional reaction. And then we have an opportunity to really start applying some critical rational evaluation to what we're seeing.
Well, when talking about confirmation bias, what role do algorithms play in social media?
Well, you know, different types of algorithms on social media platforms are really designed to personalize content, right? They do that in different ways, but the basic idea is that the algorithm is trying to figure out what it is that you want to see, what it is that you want to engage with kind of the goal of keeping you on the platform longer. And so those algorithms are just, in a way, they're responding to what you've already done on social media, but it's also trying to respond to the things that you're searching for, clicking on, engaging with.
Yeah. And as we just discussed with PolitiFact, social media giants are grappling with how to handle misinformation and disinformation. You went through some tools that we can keep at front of mind, but what more can be done by users to keep misinformation and disinformation at bay?
Well, I think partly we have to acknowledge our role in the spread of misinformation. So much of what gets shared and goes viral is not because of the sources that are creating it and putting it out there. It's us. Like, we are amplifying this. And so by taking responsibility for that and being more cautious with what we share, that can go a long way towards mitigating this. And we have to learn how to do that and practice that in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Because social media can be a great place to find information, but you can also fall down that rabbit hole and find yourself reading something that isn't true. I go on to look for one thing, and then 30 minutes later, you know, I'm still on the app. So maybe it's just putting the brakes on a little bit and pausing.
I think pausing it, but also I think we also have to acknowledge that, you know, social media became a very important tool for us during the pandemic, right? We became physically disconnected from people. And so maybe one of the ways that we can also do this is to look at social media, not necessarily as a source of news, but let's refocus social media on the social aspect, connecting with friends, family, and loved ones, and sharing pictures of our cute pets and babies and what we had for dinner last night.
Yeah. I mean, there really is a savviness to it, which takes time. And scrolling is in many ways the opposite of time or length of time. And these posts, the reality is they don't exist in a vacuum. They filter into conversations and relationships. So how do you talk to a friend who is sharing misinformation without causing an argument?
Well, one of the most important things you have to acknowledge before you go into a conversation like that is that they, in all likelihood, genuinely believe something is true, right? You cannot be confrontational or demeaning in that conversation, right? So there is a certain amount of empathy that's required to be able to sort of recognize, okay, I believe this, you believe something different. Can we talk about it? And can we ask each other questions? And can we share our sources and look at them together, right? It's that questioning and conversation and trying to talk about it through a personal connection rather than like, I can't believe you believe this, and trying to like shout each other down. Like, that's not productive.
Yeah.
Right. So we have to have empathy. And then the other part is like, you have to be patient, right? If someone didn't rationalize themselves into this false belief quickly, it took time. And so you're not necessarily going to rationalize them out of it in a short period of time. So you have to be patient. You have to have empathy. And then if this person's really important to you, you have to keep at it.
Yeah. And emotions play a role in that as well.
They absolutely do. And that's the thing. If you feel like a conversation is edging towards confrontation, or if you feel like there's tension that's happening, you just have to back away and recognize that maybe we can come back to it. But it's all, above all else, you have to avoid confrontation in that conversation.
Before we let you go, John, as journalists, we're skilled at verifying information through reputable sources, and that can be a lift. We just heard from PolitiFact. But when people leave this conversation, what should they take away and apply when they head back to social media apps?
If you are trying to figure out what's going on and trying to follow what's happening in the Ukraine or with any other major event, recognize that there are journalists who work for standards-based news organizations who are trying to report what's happening fairly and accurately. And if you're trying to be informed, find those journalists, find those news organizations who are trying to inform us rather than the ones who are trying to persuade or manipulate us.
John Silva is with the News Literacy Project. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
The nonprofit works with journalists and schools to help people understand how to discern fact from fiction. Up next, mask on, mask off, new changes to California's mask mandate. Cap Radio's Nicole Nixon breaks down who is eligible and when. Plus, counting homelessness. Our Chris Nichols explains how and why it's done and the importance of getting an accurate population count. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. As of today, California is loosening mask mandates. Those unvaccinated officially no longer need to wear face coverings indoors. And March 12th is another big day in the evolution of the pandemic. That's when students, regardless of vaccination status in California, will no longer need to wear masks in classrooms at schools across the state. The issue has been the source of debate, protests, and grassroots organizing. The most recent numbers from the state show a 2.9 positivity rate compared to a 12.3 exactly a month ago. And that number was over 20% in early January. A couple of local school districts have already given the go-ahead to remove masks in schools, including Roseville and Grass Valley. So while this may be good news for kids and parents who want to ditch masks, it does come with some caution from state public health leaders. Cap Radio state politics reporter Nicole Nixon is here with the details on the new guidance and the word of warning. Nicole, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Glad to be here.
First off, Nicole, if unvaccinated people can take their masks off indoors as of today, why wait until March 12th for schools?
Well, the Newsom administration, in talking about this, points out that schools are kind of different. You and I can choose which store to go into, which business to go to, if they're requiring masks or not. Kids have to go to school. A lot of them have to go to after school programs. They have to go there to get, you know, food for a lot of kids. So they point out that they're kind of seen in this different light. And then Health and Human Services Secretary Dr. Mark Galli says that, you know, he points out that kids and teens have lower vaccination rates than other groups in the state. That 5 to 11 age group has only been eligible to get vaccinated for a few months. And then kids under 5 in preschool, pre-K, they're still not eligible yet. So they really point to also this map that the CDC has. It rates every county in the nation by rate of coronavirus transmission and hospital numbers. And if you look at California, most counties are still considered high or medium risk. Sacramento County is in that medium. LA, a lot of Central Valley are still high risk. So he says in about 2 weeks, those numbers are projected to come down even more. And at that point, they think it'll be safer for kids and teachers to remove masks.
Although the state is lifting the mask mandates, they are leaving discretion to local governments. They can impose stricter rules than the states, meaning a school district or a city even could still have masking rules. Are you hearing any of that will continue?
Yeah, there are a couple school districts I've seen so far that want to keep masks a bit longer in other areas of the state. San Francisco is one. San Diego is another. In San Diego, they say that they will drop that mask requirement when the county's COVID numbers go down. Again, that CDC map. Sacramento County told us yesterday that they will stay aligned with the state. And Elk Grove Unified actually sent a letter to families saying that they look forward to ending school mask requirements on March 12th.
California isn't alone in this. The decision is actually in conjunction with Oregon and Washington. We heard about this tri-state partnership early on in the pandemic, like I'm talking April of 2020 during the Trump administration. Why is this still being done together? What does it mean now?
Yeah, it's a good question because we actually haven't seen much from this sort of Western states group in a long time. Like you mentioned, in 2020, these governors kind of joined forces to ask for pandemic aid from the federal government. They made this Western states vaccine work group. And it's interesting because Washington and Oregon had actually already announced that they were going to end their school mask requirements. Those dates were a bit later, though. They actually moved them up by a week or 10 days with yesterday's announcements. And I mean, this is kind of speculation, but there were some East Coast states a couple weeks ago that announced plans to drop mask requirements. It's just likely that these states kind of started to feel the pressure to follow suit.
As with anything in the pandemic, not everyone is happy about this. Are you able to tap in and gauge if this lifting and loosening of mask mandates is consistent overall with how Californians feel?
It's interesting, yeah, because there was a UC Berkeley Institute for Governmental Studies poll that came out just last week showing there are clear majorities from voters and parents that actually support masking in schools. At the same time, though, we've been seeing a lot of protests by parents, you know, at school boards, at schools against mask mandates. We saw some dust-ups in Roseville and Grass Valley over, you know, districts getting rid of the mask mandates and teachers calling in sick, getting school canceled. But again, there's this poll that shows, you know, statewide there are majorities of parents and voters that support masking. It's kind of interesting. One thing that stuck out to me is that voters who don't have a child were actually more likely, about 5 percentage points, to support masks in schools than actual parents. And there are big breakdowns, you know, along political ideology. We've seen this, though, throughout the pandemic, Democrats and liberals much more likely to support school mask and vaccine requirements than Republicans.
Before we let you go, Nicole, State of the State is coming up soon, traditionally in March. Are you picking up any political undertones or strategy by the Newsom administration in making this decision at this time?
I mean, I think the big thing is that the Newsom administration has had to sort of balance this ongoing and ramped up pressure in the past few weeks from parents and students and families that they want to end school masking, or at least they want a choice to take their masks off if they want, with what the teachers unions, you know, consistently wanting to keep these mask mandates. What I'm really looking for in this, the state of the state, when that comes up, maybe later this month, is how the governor addresses the pandemic. I just keep coming back to this moment in June last year. It was like sort of triumphant, like reopening where he was at Universal Studios with the Minions and all of that. And it was very different just, you know, 2 weeks ago when he was outlining his next pandemic phase plan, and much more tempered, acknowledging the virus is, you know, going to be with us for a long time. And it's not going to be, at least for a while, this back to normal that people have been expecting.
Still a lot to follow. Thanks, Nicole.
Thank you.
Nicole Nixon is Cap Radio's state politics reporter. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. Volunteers across the United States set out last week to count the number of people experiencing homelessness in their communities. Here in Sacramento County, more than 700 volunteers canvassed downtown business districts, as well as suburban and rural neighborhoods. It's all in an effort to tally the number of people living on the streets and to hear their stories. That includes Cap Radio reporter Chris Nichols, who joined the Sacramento point-in-time count and joins us this morning to share his reporting. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Vicki. Good to be here.
Remind us what the goal of the point-in-time count is.
Well, the goal is to take a snapshot, really an estimate of how many people are homeless in communities across the nation, and to figure out how much progress has been made, or whether the problem has gotten worse. And here in the Sacramento region and in counties across the state, there's a widely shared expectation that the problem has gotten much worse due to the pandemic, And of course, due to our extreme lack of affordable housing.
Right. The expectation and the feeling, but it's important to actually measure it. Remind us how often these counts take place and what were the latest numbers from Sacramento County?
Well, the surveys usually take place every 2 years, but this was the first time since 2019 that volunteers have conducted the Sacramento count. And that's because many surveys, both here and across the state, were canceled last year due to the pandemic. Our region's last count 3 years ago found more than 5,500 homeless people across Sacramento County.
Is this on a volunteer basis by counties and local jurisdictions, or is it mandatory?
This is essentially mandatory. These counts are required in order for communities to receive funding from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development for things like homeless shelters and housing and services. And that final number for Sacramento County, once it is released in a report later this spring, that will help determine how much money our region gets.
Chris, you went there yourself. You spoke with some of the people who run the count and analyze the numbers. What did you learn?
I spoke with Sacramento State Professor Arturo Baiocchi, and he's an associate professor in the Division of Social Work. His team helps analyze and report out the results. He talked with me about the value of participating in this count and about one of the myths about homeless people and where they come from.
We all talk about homelessness, we see homelessness, but here's a chance for any community member to really participate and talk to folks who are experiencing homelessness and realizing that they're members of our community. One of the things we learned in the 2019 count is we asked folks where they're from, and 92% of folks said they're from Sacramento. And that really challenged, I think, people's misperceptions, thinking that it's folks from somewhere else coming in. And every community throughout the West Coast is facing these sort of issues. And so it's something that everybody's struggling with. And so, but I think it starts with acknowledging that there are community members as well.
Yeah, and that's so important. I have personally learned so much reporting on this issue and actually speaking with individuals experiencing homelessness. So let's actually get to some of the people you met who are on the streets during last week's count. What were the common themes that you noticed?
Well, one common theme, just following up on the professor's point, is most of these people told me they were from Sacramento or had lived here for quite a few years. The group of volunteers that I tagged along with, they surveyed part of downtown and midtown near Capitol Park. And for some context, this was the coldest night of the year. So there were probably fewer people who were at least visibly homeless than, say, on a warmer night. But about a dozen people, mostly middle-aged men, were either camped at parks or in doorways, and they were willing to speak with us. As far as themes go, many said they came from broken homes, broken relationships. Some had spent time in foster homes. Some had families. Some were divorced. They talked about their jobs, their careers. Some talked about drug and alcohol use and mental illness. And our group spoke with 61-year-old Mark Odin at the Safeway parking lot in Midtown. Volunteer Steve Graham and I spoke with him. And here's a summary of our conversation that's been edited down.
How long have you been homeless?
Best guess, 11 years.
11 years, okay.
You said you worked as a truck driver for how long again?
In total, I was in the trucking industry in logistics and transportation for 42 years. I started when I turned 18.
Do you feel a mental disability keeps you from holding a job or stable housing?
You know what? After being out here for 11 years, I'm starting to wonder.
That's fair.
There are a lot of people out here that are homeless that do have diminished mental faculties, and they need to be handled a certain way. But not everyone is like that. Some people are competent. Some people are willing to help out, do what they can. But we get shot down for it because everybody's grouped together. I say we. You know, I sit back and don't deal with a lot of that, but, you know, I'm part of that. And, you know, it's like there's a few people and I, we go out and we, you know, do trash cleanup, stuff like that. This trailer and another one, I've got four tickets for having a trailer in the American River Parkway. One ranger actually said, hey, you know what, you're doing a nice thing, and they gave me a ticket anyway.
So that's some of the frustration there that Mark talked about. But he also told me that he suffered an injury in the trucking business, and that contributed to him landing on the streets.
Yeah, I've met multiple people that actually work full-time jobs and are still experiencing homelessness. Right before last week's point and count, though, Chris, community leaders actually gathered at Sacramento State to meet with volunteers at a kickoff event. What was the point of that?
Well, several city and county officials spoke at that event. Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg was one of them. He had some interesting comments. He said he had mixed feelings about the count. He told me in an interview before the kickoff that he didn't want the overall number to distract from the work needed to address the crisis.
I don't worry about it. I know the number's big. I know there's tremendous human need out there. That's what I know. What the exact number is to me is less important than what we are going to do as a follow-up and a follow-through to actually require all levels of government to bring people indoors at a faster pace and to provide them the help, the mental health treatment, the services that so many people need. It's the point in time count is necessary. The follow-up is more important. And I just hope that there is as much energy around bringing people indoors and helping them off the streets as there is in counting them.
Right, because Chris, as you just said, the number is expected to be higher than the last count 3 years ago, and that can feel demoralizing and frustrating for people that want solutions and realistic solutions and visible ones at that. The mayor has proposed a number of initiatives to improve the homeless situation in Sacramento. You reported on some potential November ballot measures that seek to help. Where does the mayor stand on them?
Well, Steinberg is generally supportive of these proposals. The first ballot measure, which still, of course, has to gather signatures to qualify, it would require the city of Sacramento to create thousands of new shelter spaces and to eventually outlaw homeless encampments on public property once those shelter spaces are offered to people. County Supervisor Patrick Kennedy has said he'll introduce a similar countywide measure this spring, but these measures are in very early stages. There's no guarantee that they'll end up on the ballot.
But something's happening tonight, I believe, or later today. There's a possible change that could have a direct effect on people who are experiencing homelessness much sooner. The Sacramento City Council is expected to consider a change affecting warming centers later today. What's that all about?
Well, the council later today will be asked to reverse a decision that it made a year ago, specifically a vote that it made, making it easier to open emergency warming and cooling centers for people on the streets. So the council members agreed to get rid of the weather-based criteria that limited when the centers could open. But the city has struggled to staff these overnight facilities. Officials say they don't have enough trained staff to do this on a regular basis and for extended periods of time. So the city manager's office said in a staff report that opening the centers without the weather-based criteria, quote, creates an undue expense and burden on city resources, end quote.
I imagine there's going to be a good amount of public comment later today. Chris, thank you for joining us and look forward to having you back on this issue.
Thanks, Vicki. Great to be here.
That is CAP Radio reporter Chris Nichols sharing with us his reporting on Sacramento County's first point-in-time count for those experiencing homelessness, and it is the first count in 3 years. Still ahead, we visit Underground Books, a long-overdue Oak Park literary pillar in a neighborhood long without a public library. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Since St. Hope was established, its mission has been to help create a revitalized Oak Park that benefits the people who have long called the historically Black neighborhood home. Over the past 33 years, St. Hope has created charter schools, helped bring Black-owned businesses to the area, and provided a space that shows how representation matters through a bookstore. In 2003, the organization opened Underground Books, a Black-owned bookshop that has become a literary hub in Oak Park after the closure of the only public library there back in the 1970s. Joining us now to tell us all about St. Hope and Underground Books is Cassandra Jennings, President and CEO of St. Hope. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Cassandra, you have long been embedded in the community. How did you first become involved with St. Hope, and what drew you to its mission?
Well, many years ago, I had the opportunity to actually work in Oak Park with the redevelopment agency. At that time, what we saw was disinvestment, decline, blight, and more challenges that come around that with poverty and lack of jobs in Oak Park, which I understood I wasn't there, but was a thriving community. And so part of the mission was obviously to do the part on the redevelopment side, but then to partner with entities that would then be able to be catalytic as well as be able to lift up the community. And so I was able to connect with St. Hope at that time, which really was the beginning of what I think is just transformational work in Oak Park. So we were able to really transfer the old Woodruff Hotel to St. Hope to become what is now 40 acres and all the thriving and sort of supportive community activities that occur every day there.
Yeah, there are so many arms to St. Hope. If you can help us visualize, how is it representative of the Oak Park community?
Yeah, so there are actually four components to St. Hope. As you mentioned, there's the TK through 12 public school system. That's a charter school. And it is representative because it serves families and students from the community and from also those underserved communities like African-Americans, Latinos, and any that have been overlooked and left behind. So we have that big because education is both the short-term and the long-term game to create successful family wealth and just opportunities. But then we also have the development side, which means we take properties like the old Woodruff Hotel and some other properties, we redevelop them and then bring in additional services. So the tenants in those facilities like the Urban League and City Year and College Track also support the community and the different things that are happening. And then also we have the academy that provides services and does a lot of outreach to the community. And so that's when we really want to see what are the current issues, how can we resolve them? And then they all work together to create jobs, opportunities, and just enlightening.
Yeah. Let's touch upon the College Track and the results of that. What are the graduation rates and transfer rates for seniors who go off to a university?
Well, we are proud to say that the St. Hope Public Schools and Sac High senior graduating class has more than 95% of their students that are accepted to four-year universities. That is unheard of. They are accepted to all the UC schools and state schools, as well as over 25 historical Black college universities. So we have a system there that's academically bound that brings culture and opportunities to support it. So that's the St. Hope Public School and their graduation rate. The opportunity for College Track is that they get kids not only from St. Hope, but throughout the county, and they track them. Well, they support them through from middle school through college to make sure that some of those things that have become obstacles in all of our lives are not deterrents to the goals that they're trying to achieve. So I think the beauty about it is that we have a foundation and a solid system, and then we try to build around that the supportive systems that will lead to success.
When you talk about disinvestment, historically that has taken place in Oak Park, you know, what strikes me is that the public library was removed in the 1970s, and now you have Underground Books, which serves as a literary hub in Oak Park. How did that come about?
Well, I when we assess what were the needs, it was clear. And I'd have to say that Mother Rose, Georgia West, was sort of the impetus, and it's her baby. She knew that there were no libraries. She grew up in this neighborhood. She raised her son, grew up in this neighborhood. And it was her commitment to make sure that literacy was still a part of the fabric of Oak Park. And what we see now is that Underground Books is an opportunity for access, for exploration, for diversity, for information, for challenging your thoughts, all there. And I think what is even just so enlightening is the diversity in the stories and the books that they have, not only for children and youth, but also for us adults as well.
Yeah, I have many a times been a customer at Underground Books, and quickly you see that it's way more than a bookstore.
Yes, yes. And that was in 2020, during the pandemic, there was something good happening, is that they had an opportunity to really revitalize and spruce up the store. And so now it's like a marketplace. You can come and get all kinds of things that are, and that supports small business and Black-owned businesses in the community. And you can also come and sit and read a book and feel comfortable. And then we have programming that happens. And after COVID, and we're coming out of it, we'll have a lot of more things for people to come and engage with, more book signings like we used to have. And we now have what we call is Let's Read Oak Park for children from 6 to 10 years of age. And on the second Saturdays, they come in, they're being read to, they have arts and crafts, plus then they get to take home a book. And we can also, we also engage their parents and give them a book also. And so it's like literacy is opening up your mind. It brings opportunity and hope for everyone.
Yeah,
right there in Underground Books.
Yeah, and showing you what's possible. I mean, you're talking about these arms of education from schools to a college track to a bookstore. And I'm just learning that there's also a housing component to this as well, right?
Yes. Now, the original revitalization of sort of that corner at 35th and Broadway includes 12 apartment units, and they're right above the Underground Books. So it's part of that urban vibrancy right there in Oak Park. And we think that there should be an opportunity to do some more of that someplace else in Oak Park. So we're certainly working on that because, as you know, housing is a big issue and affordability is one too. So I would say that in the 40 acres complex, we have the 12 upper rooms, but we also were the catalyst of additional housing in the community, and we hope to be certainly involved in bringing more housing opportunities to Oak Park area.
Yeah, building a community that's sustainable. Before we let you go, we have about a minute or so, and the year is zooming by. So can you give us a sneak peek of your plans that you have for Juneteenth?
Oh, it's going to be exciting. We're going to be talking about electric cars and emissions. We're going to have a great performer that's really just going to bring everybody and draw them. It's going to be a main stage. You don't want to miss it. But then we're going to have a lot of activities around reading and opportunities. We're going to have things for all segments of the family. So a kids zone. We're going to be at Esther's Park. It's going to be a festival that's not only going to be fun and bring a gathering place to Oak Park and 40 acres, but it's going to be educational too. And people are going to leave there saying, oh, I'm going to come back because I like what I heard and I like what I learned.
And from now until then, you still have some events that people can attend, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Lots of things going on at the Guild Theater. There was a comedy show the other night. There's going to be one this Sunday. There's going to be a movie matinee free at 2 p.m. And at the bookstore, we're getting ready for Let's Read Oak Park in 2 weeks. And then we have vendors, local vendors all the time. So it changes up. So we want you to come to Underground Books. We want you to experience 40 Acres and the Oak Park that is thriving and vibrant for everyone.
Thank you so much, Cassandra.
Thank you, Vicki.
Cassandra Jennings is the president and CEO of St. Hope in Sacramento's Oak Park neighborhood. That is it for Insight today. You can learn about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Antonio Muniz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.